How many of us live with the tension of what might have been, what could have been? That whole thought, that whole tension is a big piece of the issue that we began talking about last week, and that's this thing of the holy discontent that Jesus was planting in the heart and the mind of this lady at the well, this Samaritan woman who had never had any encounter with Jesus, with really God from a personal level. And then all of a sudden, boom, here he was right in front of her. If you recall the story, Jesus had to go from Judea to Galilee, and he took, rather than the roundabout route that many Jews take to avoid the area of Samaria, he took the straight road, the shortest distance between two points, which would take him right through the heart of the area of the land of the people that the Jews hated the most. And because he was a Jew by physical birth, the assumption was when he came upon this lady that Jesus' attitude toward her would be just like that of every other Jew that she had ever encountered. For the Jews and the Samaritans did not get along. But in the process, he took the opportunity to change her and to turn her into someone that she had never been before. And as we kind of move through this today, I want us to understand a couple of things before we leave. And I want us to go back to a couple of the questions that we noted last week. We opened up and we asked the question, and I think we created an uncomfortable moment for many of us when I asked you to analyze your life real briefly, and I asked you two questions. What is missing from your life? And number two, what is in your life that shouldn't be there? And we kind of had a little fun with that, although it was somewhat agonizing, I imagine, to a degree. And so, as we looked at that, we come to realize that that's kind of what Jesus would be, the kind of question that Jesus would be asking this lady. For the woman at the well had never been challenged as she would be challenged on this day. So what we're going to do, we introduced some ideas last week that we're going to drill more deeply into today as we move further into the text, as we move through the story. And the story itself is one that's rather lengthy in terms of the page coverage, you might say, that John chooses to give this particular story. And it's in chapter 4, if you weren't with us last week, and that's where we are. And we're going to be starting around verse 13 this week. But before we go there, I want us to consider a couple of things. One of the things that was stated in the narrative that we heard earlier on the video about the woman at the well was the statement, "What he gave me was too much for me, and so I had to go tell others." You see, that's the key to who Jesus is. He's too much for me. It's too much for me to absorb. It's too much for me to take advantage of without doing what? Without influencing others with the Word. It was really encouraging because, you know, I hadn't even gotten home last week when I received an email from one of our folks who had already written me a narrative about how they had taken the story of the woman at the well and what we talked about last week and administered already, copied me on the email and everything, to a friend who was going through some really difficult issues. There was some application that she found in what we talked about, and I thought she did an incredible job. She said it a whole lot better than I did last Sunday morning, and of sharing with her friend and helping her. And that's an example of where someone acknowledged that this thing about Jesus is too much for her to hold to herself. And it's there for us to do what? To share and to influence others, to help others with their issues and with their problems. So I want to just remind us that Jesus is indeed much too much for us to hold in ourselves. Much too much. Well, we kind of closed out last week by making the point that a real encounter with Jesus creates a holy discontent in me by creating an awareness of a couple of things. And the first of those things would be my greatest need. The first thing that a Jesus encounter will do will naturally make me aware of my greatest need. Now, what is my greatest need? Well, Jesus had already talked about this living water thing, right? And she didn't really understand what it was all about. And so at this point, he begins to speak to it. And in the previous verses we saw where he had talked about it, and she didn't really understand. And so this thing about Jesus communicating the greatest need, we see that in verses 13 and 14. Jesus answered to the lady. She was asking, Lord, what is this, or sir? Didn't call him Lord, right? But knew enough pretty much to call him sir. What is this living water you're talking about? Jesus answered, everyone who drinks this water will be thirsty again, but whoever drinks the water that I give him will never thirst. Indeed, the water I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. We also talked about the fact that so often we discount the validity and the veracity and the magnitude of eternal life by assuming that it begins with death, when in reality it begins at the point of conversion. That's when eternal life begins. That's when this life with Jesus, this salvation thing, really begins. Here's the point. Jesus regularly communicates to us this way. The problem is we often don't allow him our attention. Does that make sense? Keep in mind, he was face to face with the woman at the well. The quality of conversation, by the way, and here's a little bit of a soapbox that I'm going to get on. The quality of conversation is infinitely timed, infinitely better face to face than any other communication technique that you can think of. I don't care what you. I don't care what the trends are today. You can never convince me that any of that stuff is even close to being as good and effective and rich as face to face conversation. And we have the opportunity in a personal relationship with Jesus to be face to face with Him, right? And so one of the things that happens here, he has a captive audience with the woman at the well. They're sitting there, and as we said last week, this well was very deep. It was the well that commemorated and was indicative of the land that Joseph had given to Jacob. It was a very holy site for the Samaritans. Also, we know that there was likely no one else around because she came right about mealtime when everybody else had already come and gotten their water, and they were feeding their families, right? She came at a very inconspicuous time. Why? Because Jesus would ultimately reveal, you know what, she had something that she needed to hide. She was a lady who was not viewed in such a way that she was really looking forward to being seen in public. She was probably that kind of person that whenever she saw somebody else, she would have made a statement like this, whether she would say it aloud or whether it would just kind of be one of those things she would keep to herself. I wonder what they think of me. She was probably the kind of person that if you were to meet on the road, she would probably look down at the road. Or if you were to be with her in an elevator, rather than speak to the other person in the elevator, you know, she would watch the digital readout, which told you which floor you were on. None of us have ever done that. I'm sure we all are wonderful conversation starters when we're in elevators, right? We all do that. We never avoid people, right? We never do that. Oftentimes, many of us take the stairs not to get exercise, but to avoid the elevator encounters, right? But the point was, the reason for being into herself might be different. It wasn't just shyness or being an introvert, so to speak. She would have something to hide. She would have been viewed, even in the Samaritan community, where the standards of behavior were not as stringent and were not as moralistic, say, as in the Jewish community, she would have probably been someone who would have been very conscious of moral issues. Well, Jesus, with this whole idea about living water, would plant in her this desire eventually, and this picture of what could be in her life. And he did this by communicating her greatest need. Her greatest need would be this living water. Jesus does this with us in everyday circumstances. There are multiple opportunities for us to come face to face with Jesus. And if you're like me, you miss out on so many of them that you don't even want to admit. You know what? We don't want to admit because a lot of times we don't even think about them. Because that's not what our first mind, that's not the first thought our mind is set on, is it? We're wrapped up in what's going on that day and what we've got to do. And that's why it's so important for us to understand what it means to live an integrated, holistic life. Not with Jesus compartmentalized in one little place over here where we bring him out when it's convenient. We kind of have him in a little cage, kind of like we have a little house dog now, which I swore I'd never do. But when you got a 17-year-old girl who knows to look like a sad puppy whenever she wants something, right, it's hard to resist it. You know what I'm saying? And you feel sorry for her and you say yes. Oh, I'm going away to college. I'm not going to have, I've never had a dog. I'd love to have a dog. Little did I think about, you know, what's the dog going to do when she does go away to college? And they don't allow pets in the dorm. So, no, I can't do this. So we have a dog that is free, okay? Anybody who wants a Feist, just let me know. Don't tell my daughter, but, you know, it'll be yours. But anyway, we tend not to think about these things, but when we integrate Jesus into the holistic aspect of our lives, what happens? He kind of pops out here and there. It takes work. It takes effort. It's not easy. It takes, you know, someone, I was with, one of the things we did Thursday night and Friday, we had one of our retreats with our innovative church community lead team. And these are the guys who lead the different regional sites around the state for us. And we came together at a conference center in Hickory, and we were planning out what we're going to do for the coming year and beyond, and looking at how we can best help equip churches and help pastors be better leaders in their regions. And so one of the things that came out, one dude, every time, periodically we noticed that he had a really wild alarm. It was either on his watch or his computer, I can't really remember. And it kept going off at certain times, not so frequently that it was annoying or anything. And finally somebody said, "Jason, what is the alarm for?" And he said, "Well, that's my reminder that to ask the question. I know whenever I hear that alarm, I know to ask the question, am I doing right now what I should be doing?" Wow. I was thinking, wow, that's pretty good. You know, you're about two-thirds of my age, and you're that disciplined to do that. I'm impressed. But you know what? We all need an alarm at some point in time that tells us, or that we need to ask ourselves the question, are we doing at that moment what we really need to be doing? And for many of us, if we understand what it means to be a Christ follower, that part of what we ought to be doing is going to include Jesus as a part of the answer to the question, right? Fortunately, with Jason, he had begun to discipline himself in that regard. And I'm thinking, man, he's probably going to be a whole lot more fruitful and productive in his life if he's getting this down at this early age for himself. So how do you make sure that Jesus is integrated into the whole of your life so that when he wants to get your attention, he can? What's missing in your life that's going to allow you to do that? And what is in your life that shouldn't be there that might be keeping you from being able to do that? It's a question that we all need to consider. So this tension about the holy discontent, by the way, many people are discontented. They're just flat out discontented. They're thinking about what might have been had the coach put me in the fourth quarter in high school. And I'm 45 years old now. And all I can do is go back. I got guys I graduated with, and they've been living in the past for the past 30 years. Every time we come together, all they can talk about is the past, the high school days. Those were the good old days, da-da-da. And I'm thinking, my goodness, when are you ever going to get beyond that? And then I hired one of them when I was at AT&T, and I got to hear it every day. But anyway, so here's the tension is with this holy discontent that Jesus creates an awareness in me, first of all, of my greatest need, but he also makes me aware of my desire for something more, a desire for something more. And see, here's the funny thing. Many of us don't even realize that we have a desire for something more. Many of us have gotten used so much to the complacent way of life that we live right now that we have successfully, psychologically suppressed the desire for something more. And we have allowed complacency to override the desire. We've allowed complacency to override motivation. Does that make sense for you? Some of us are so ingrained in where we are today and what we're doing that we don't even want to think about what life might be like beyond. oftentimes those of us who do dare to dream, we get frustrated because we recognize that the obstacles are there and we're thinking maybe we can never overcome the obstacles. Maybe the obstacles will never allow us to go where we need to go. One of the funny stories is kind of a neat story that just kind of began to take shape for me this week. All of us as parents, we struggle at times with parenting and with our children, et cetera. And particularly when it gets to that time where children become teenagers and then begin to ask the question, what am I going to do? What am I going to be? And da-da-da, all that stuff. You know, it's funny because, one of the things that my son has, even I think that even transcends his ability to play guitar and such, is his ability to be a landscaper. And just taking, he just has that eye, he has this knack. He's had that for a long time when he started mowing yards and doing little jobs for people around the neighborhood when he was 11 and 12 years old. And so he's always, I said, Jake, you're really good at that. You need to really explore that. Whether you do that as your full-time occupation or whatever, it probably has a place. And his thing was, Dad, look, everywhere you see, there's a landscaping truck. There are like 80 million businesses just around Burlington. That'll never work. It'll never happen. And so, we just continued to, in his words, nag him about it, to think about it, right? And so he really began to pick up some stuff. He went to work for a guy, and then this year he decided, I'd like to try to maybe do some things on my own and balancing that with school. And so his business really picked up when we went out on faith and bought a tractor, okay? And as soon as we bought the tractor, guess what happened? All those snows came in the winter. So my wife had the idea, it's clearing parking lots. So we called everybody we knew that had a parking lot, and he stayed like busy for 2 or 3 days completely for just clearing parking lots, right? And so ultimately what happened, things began to explode. All of a sudden, this stuff happened. He got this job here, these mowing jobs here, and all of a sudden he's got so much now that he doesn't know what he can do. Now, what do I attribute that to? I attribute that to the faithfulness of parents who pray daily for the favor of their children, as well as something like habits of tithing, right? I believe that God rewards your generosity and your obedience faithfully. And many of you know my story about how we were in our mid-20s, and I was resistant to this idea of tithing because I was with a new corporate, new career and doing real well, and I didn't want to give any of my money away. And my wife said, you know what, we're doing wrong by not tithing. And God used her to convict me, and we started doing it. We haven't looked back since. And it was funny because, this whole idea of God just kind of giving to the overflow, I was kind of reminded this week when I was working out, I do my workout in the morning, and while I'm on my treadmill or my elliptical, whichever one I'm doing, I know it's hard for you to believe that I do that, but I really do, faithfully, and I go hard on that. I really do. I was praying. I said, specifically, I said, God, I said, just give Jake, I know he's already saying he's got more than he can handle, but give him some new jobs this week, today. And he would not like me to pray that prayer because he feels overwhelmed already. But anyway, I went to wake him up to go to school that morning. He said, he was playing with his phone. He said, I got a message from this guy who wanted me to look at his yard and kind of told me, first of all, that he didn't think he wanted to pay for it. Now he wants me to do it every week. And so then later on that very day, another guy called with the same thing. Two new jobs that one day. I said, well, Jake, I said, it's funny because I prayed specifically this morning that God would send you some new business, And we're sitting there last night at Blue Ribbon because, last night was prom night for my daughter, and he'd done a lot of work outside to try to get ready for pictures and all that stuff. And so we took he and his girlfriend to dinner, and we were just sitting there. And usually I'm the person that knows everybody, right? And he's knowing everybody in Blue Ribbon, right? And somebody comes up to him right there on the spot in a conversation about 2 minutes. He's got another new job. And I'm like, did you just get a new job out of that? And by this time, although I prayed for it, I'm getting a little, I'm getting a little worked up about it. I'm saying, well, this is a little too much, God, But what happens is we don't recognize, because of constraints and obstacles, that we really have a desire for something more. You see, he looked at the obstacle, for example, of, there's a landscaping truck on every corner around here. There are 80 million businesses here for, 100,000 people in our county. And we can't see, often we can't see beyond that until something happens that catalyzes what we're calling this, in this new message series, a new point of view for us. You see, God is always pushing for in us a new point of view, a new way of looking for something. The woman said to Jesus, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and have to keep coming here to draw water." So, it's not until we really sense, number one, my greatest need, and number two, my desire for something more, that we begin to be able to move beyond. There's stories that many of you have where you have experienced this holy discontent. And God placed in you a recognition of what you need to be doing. It might have been your vocation. I'm looking at right now and seeing some of you. You realize, you know, what you had been doing was not exactly what you should be doing. There was something more God had for you. You took the plunge. You took the step of faith. You went for it. And God rewarded you like He would reward the woman at the well. It's a great story. And so we tend to move beyond the status quo. We are able to take away the layers of complacency that keep us from understanding that there is something more that we truly desire. And it is only then that we can begin to move forward. Many of us have this discontentedness, right? Like, what was it, Kip and Rico, right? In our little Napoleon Dynamite example. But is it a holy discontent? Is it a discontentedness that drives us toward greater holiness in our lives? Is it a discontentedness that drives us toward stepping out on faith and doing something that we might never have done before? Is it a discontentedness that drives us closer to a lifestyle that is defined by a holistic relationship with Jesus and not a compartmentalized relationship with Jesus? So the tension of the holy discontentedness, really quickly, is really around this, when you get down to it. It's first of all between what is and has been, the way it is. You know, you kind of like the saying, you know, it is what it is. That's one of the most profound and ingenious statements I've ever heard in my life. You know, it is what it is. Did it come from Confucius or maybe Solomon out of the Bible or something? But the sad part is I found myself using it lately. So, I don't know, maybe I think there's something to it in reality. He told her, "Go call your husband and come back." She said, "Sir, I have no husband." Jesus replied to her, "You're right when you say you have no husband. The fact is, you have had five of them. And the man you now have is not your husband. You're living with him, but he's not your husband. What you have just said is indeed quite true." Now, what has Jesus just done here? He takes one little statement that she made, and what was her intent? What was her intent? Well, we'll look at that in a minute. But she said a factual statement, "I have no husband." That's all she said, these four words. And all of a sudden, Jesus totally analyzes her history. You see, well, we'll get to that in a minute. The fact is, you've had five husbands. The man you have now is not your husband. What you have just said is quite true, that you don't have a husband. You don't have one right now, but hey, how about historically? What's been going on with you, girl? You know, let's be real here. Don't try to hide something. Well, so the first thing is this, is it's what is and has been that we focus on. Now, I want us, you know what, I think I might have switched up your outline, so I want to get to the right thing. Go to the next slide for me, Pete, would you? Yeah, okay. All right, no, we're good, we're good. Let me tell you how we often avoid the holy discontent here. And we talked about this last week. Remember what we said last week, how we avoid it? When Jesus really challenges us with something, what do we typically do? Something she did? We change the subject. Yeah, I heard somebody say, we change the subject. So that's what we typically do. When Jesus comes to us and challenges us, we change the subject. And so she said, you know, go call your husband, come back. She says, I have no husband. That's her first attempt at doing what? Changing the subject. Right. She was getting a little antsy, right? Because Jesus began penetrating areas emotionally and spiritually where she didn't want to go. And so she says, well, sir, I have no husband, thinking that, you know, that'll get me off the hook. Yeah, we're engaged to be married in 3 weeks. You know, we're living together, but technically he's not my husband. So I can technically get out of this by saying I have no husband. You ever use that, the technical nature of the language, right, to try to get out of something? Yeah, I have, sure. I mean, hey, that's what we pay attorneys for, right? Right? Use the technicality of the language to try to, let's find a loophole. She was looking for a loophole, right? So that she could get out of this uncomfortable confrontation that she was having. And so he goes to her and he tells her all about her history. And then what she says, sir, I can see that you're a prophet. What's that got to do with the price of eggs in Samaria? Attempt number two at what? Changing the subject. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain. Here she goes into her own theological discourse to Jesus. She's lecturing Jesus theologically now. So what do we see? Attempt number three at changing the subject. But you Jews claim that the place where we must worship is in Jerusalem. So here's what she does. She says, look, the obvious thing between you and me is the racial aspect. We're supposed to have this racism thing going on. So she did the popular thing of the day. And she said, you know what? I'm going to just do the talking points. I'm going to resort to the talking points. And you know what? This is another way for me to kind of get out of this situation. So first of all, she kind of goes to her personal life. I have no husband. Well, he kind of nails her there. Says, sir, I see you're a prophet. Well, and then she goes this whole thing. Well, let me just revert to the safe thing, what everybody else does. Because let me go to the thing that polarizes us. Because see, the Jews and the Samaritans knew a lot about polarization. They understood a lot about divide and conquer. They understood a lot about how we can build alliances when we have a common enemy. So we create these enemies even when they really don't exist. And we rally around opposition towards somebody else. And we think that is collective, communal type togetherness. And we think that's healthy when it's really not, because it's based not on what unites us, but rather on what divides us. So is there any wonder that the politics of today in the United States have been practiced throughout the world for thousands and thousands and thousands of years? Watch. What we do in society today, we don't care about what unites us. We say we do, but you know what? Everybody now has got to have a hyphen in whoever they are, right? You got to have a hyphen. Why? Are we really trying to think about what unites us, or are we really trying to focus on what keeps us apart? Not a lot of difference in the culture of today, in the culture of Jesus' time. Well, believe me, woman, Jesus said, a time is coming when you will worship the Father neither on this mountain or in Jerusalem. So what does he say? He says, look, you're wasting your time with the talking points, because that's not the issue anyway. It doesn't matter where you worship, whether it's on this mountain or whether it's in Jerusalem. The fact of the matter, where do you worship? It doesn't matter. The issue is that you do worship. And Jesus goes on to describe what that's like. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. Let me give you five ways that we avoid things, or that we change a subject. I'm going to give you five avoidance techniques. Now, you might want to write these down because they're not on your outline. First of all, we often, the way we handle this, we avoid things is, first of all, by ignoring them. We'll ignore it. Okay? Typically, we do this with relationships, whether it be marital or work or whatever the case might be. I got a conflict with somebody, so if I don't acknowledge it. Guys, we typically are really, you know, we're kind of good at this. And you know what? The gals are good at it because they clam up about it, right? You ever gotten the silent treatment, fellas? And you acted like you don't know why you get the silent treatment, but you really do know why you're getting the silent treatment? It's because we're using the technique of avoidance, right? The specific way we're doing that is through ignoring it. We think we're ignoring it, but it's really at the back of our mind, So we get the silent treatment. If she's not talking to you, dude, you know, guess what? You're probably getting the silent treatment, and you know what? You're thinking you're ignoring things, but it's really not being ignored. Your things never really get ignored. We just act like they do. The second thing that happens is we rationalize it. We rationalize it. Okay? And here's what we do. A lot of times by rationalizing, we do things that make us look better than other people. We compare ourselves a lot of times, and that's one way that we rationalize things. Now, a lot of times, human nature is that we fall prey often to something called the fundamental attribution error. The fundamental attribution error. Now, let me tell you what fundamental attribution error is. This is one of our great techniques for making sure that we look better than other people. Okay, because whenever I put somebody else up against me and I look better than them, it gives me a way to do what? Exactly. And to feel better about myself. Right? I can feel good about myself. Here's the fundamental attribution error. I'm in a grocery store. My kid's with me, right? My kid starts acting up a lot. Like they want the Cocoa Puffs and you know it's too much sugar. And so you say, there's no way I'm giving that to you because you're going to be even off the wall even more than you already are, right? And so they pitch a real fit. And so you get really upset, and in your very self-controlled way, you grab the arm and turn the body around to the back to you, and you just rear back and you do a spank. And then after the spank, you kind of look around and make sure nobody's looking, right? And then you go to the next aisle, and you're going over, and you're coming back through because you forgot something over in the frozen foods. And so as you're going back, you're going down the breakfast aisle. By the breakfast aisle, again, you see another, you hear a little commotion. And there's another parent there with their kid, only they're making the fuss over the sugar smacks, right? And all of a sudden, you catch a glimpse of the parent just kind of grabbing the arm, turning the backside of the child, and going whack. And here's what we've just done. What a brutal parent that is. They must have an incredibly dysfunctional home. I cannot believe they just did that in public. So the fundamental attribution error causes us to do what? It causes us to say, well, I had to do that to my child, but you know what? That's just the normal course of discipline that I use because I'm a good parent. I'm consistent with what I do. My child's a good child. They just had a bad moment, but that child, they're just totally dysfunctional. They probably need to be institutionalized or something. And the parent, too. So in making that comparison, what have we done? I have elevated me, right, at the expense of denigrating someone else. Fundamental attribution error. We do that a lot, and that's one of the ways that we rationalize things. Here's another approach that we take, and that's we indulge it. A lot of times, if there's an issue that we want to avoid, one of the things, this is really kind of crazy, psychologically it almost seems backwards, we try to avoid an issue by indulging it. We have an addiction, or we have, let's say there's drugs, there's alcohol, there's sex, whatever the case might be, the addiction that, you know, just, and there's so many. And so a lot of times we just think, you know what, I got it, you know, I'm just going to pretend it's not there by just going hog wild over it. We do it. A lot of times a desire to ignore will lead to a strategy of indulgence that we will tend to then hide, which leads us to the fourth thing. We hide it. We intentionally hide it so that nobody sees it. We hide. We usually hide what we indulge. Do you realize that? But God made us so that we can't totally hide everything that we indulge, right? We can't do everything. But we like to hide what we indulge. That's our fourth thing that we do. Many of you are hiding things that you're indulging. Now, your indulgence doesn't have to be an addiction. It could be a bad relationship that you have, say, with a marriage or a friend. And you know what? You treat that person like dirt, but you know what? You're hiding it. You're hiding it. you put on this nice aura, which makes everybody think that everything's cool. Because for you, image is everything, and you think that for everybody else, image is everything as well. That's what we call projection. We project on other people those values, those views that we have. We assume that they see the world the same way. That's one of the reasons that we do so much with our Five Love Languages marriage retreat, is because couples often project on each other the needs that each other have, never realizing that the typical need of the typical needs of the typical male are totally different than the typical needs of the typical female. And so we get married with all this, oh, I love him, I love her, everything's so beautiful, da da da. And then when we get to the reality of marriage, we think, oh my God, I married a monster. No, you didn't. Same, you married the person that you courted. It's just that you were too hung up, all right, in your tingles, right, to consider what that person really needed vis-a-vis what you need. And so now I'm stuck. Oh, I can get out of this marriage because we entered it under false pretenses. No, you didn't. Here's the fifth means of avoidance. We transfer blame. That's the fifth avoidance technique and the final one. Now, we're getting a lot better with this. We're getting a lot better at this in our world today, aren't we? Right. Whenever I can transfer the blame to somebody else, you know what? I can get out of it. It's not me anymore. It's not me. We do this often with regard to work habits, motivation, etc. People who tend to fall on hard luck, maybe, or people who tend not to really want to work that hard. They want to find other people who have an obligation to take care of them. You ever notice people like that? A lot of times people who like transfer blame are people who have an excuse for everything. Have an excuse. So we transfer the blame somewhere. Somewhere there's somebody who is responsible for this. Whoever it might be. It might have been a parent. It might have been a school teacher. It might have been a principal. Whatever the case might be. And so we transfer the blame. And the hallmark of this is that these people are us. We all do it to a degree, right? Here's the hallmark of this. We know this is happening when we transfer blame without having any desire to go and reconcile the issue that we're projecting the blame for in the first place. Does that make sense? We know this is happening whenever we have no desire, we place the blame, but we have no desire and take no inclination, no initiative to go forward and to reconcile the issue that we're passing the blame for in the first place. So take that test this week. On yourself, not on somebody else, okay? You really got the problem if you're going to go, oh, that person has that problem, yeah. If they really do, stay away from them. So here's the thing. The tension of the holy discontent is between what is and has been versus what can be. What can be. This is where Jesus really nails us. He gets us with this thing about what is and what has been versus what can be. Because he says to the lady, he says, look, a time is coming and is now come when the true worshipers forget about Jerusalem, forget about this hill or this well, will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For they are the kind of worshipers the Father seeks. God is spirit, and his worshipers must worship in spirit and truth. Now, unfortunately, this is one of the most misunderstood, misquoted, misinterpreted, and to be honest with you, most twisted around verses to rationalize a theology that comes from me and not come from the Bible. All right? So we've got to be careful about this verse. So an exegesis of this particular verse goes beyond the scope of what we're talking about today. We might hit it in the next couple weeks, but today it goes beyond that. So you're just going to have to, you know, when you think about it, what does this spirit and truth mean? You know, I tell you what I'll do. Todd, help me remember this. We will send out a church-wide email first part of the week that gives one of our trusted Bible commentary explanations of this verse. Okay? So you can kind of go with that. Todd, can you help me remember that? I'm thinking maybe Bible Knowledge Commentary or something like that. We'll send that out to you so you can have a little bit to go on with this, and we'll probably try to talk about it in the next couple weeks or so. But nevertheless, what is Jesus doing? Jesus says that, look, this is what your life can be. Your life can be characterized by worship of the Father in spirit and truth. Doesn't matter that you're a Samaritan. You know what? Because God loves the Samaritans just as much as He loves the Jews. You see, that's the thing. God's love for you is not predicated on the level of love that someone else has for you. Did you catch that? Did you catch that? The level of love and the type of love that God has for you is not predicated on the level of love or the type of love that someone else has for you. So God's ways are higher than our ways. His love is higher. And yet often, you know what? What we do is we dumb down in our minds. We dumb down the love that God has for us by assuming that it resembles the love that this particular person has for us. And as a result, what happens? We begin to think, I can never get there. I will always be the woman at the well. I will always be Nicodemus. Maybe well thought of in my community, but never being able to go beyond that. Because we've dumbed down the level of God's love. And therefore, we've dumbed down the level of impact that Jesus wants to have in our lives. And so we think less of ourselves. And I'm not saying we're to be egotists, okay? But some of you need a little ego in terms of who God created you to be. In terms of who God created you to be. Not in your own image, but in terms of God's image. Does that kind of make sense? So anyway, for this woman, this understanding of what can be was really wrapped up in her need to take a first step toward Jesus. The story's not over, by the way. There's much more to the story that we're going to get to. Not today. But here's one of the things that we need to, a couple things we need to recognize about figuring out what has been. Because sometimes looking ahead to what can be is constrained by what has been. Let me give you a couple of warnings right here, okay? First of all, figuring out what has been will be confusing and frightening. It will likely be confusing and frightening, and it will take time and effort. It will take time and effort. And it will also require persistence and determination. You've got to stick with it. See, it's great for us to walk out of here this afternoon and spend a few minutes between the Heat and the Celtics game and the Cavs and the Bulls game thinking, man, I'm going to start this process right now. I'm going to look at what has been in my life. And we start doing it, you know, then all of a sudden LeBron goes down and he hits a three. You know, I think I'll watch the game. But I'll get back to this. In reality, most of us never get back to it. So that's where the persistence and the determination takes precedence. That's where we got to have that, right? And so let me give you four things. I want to give you four questions to start the process with. And I think you've got these on your outline in their entirety, I believe. No, you don't? Oh, good. You got to write them down. Good. Get to work here. All right. So here are some questions to get at what is and has been in your life. First of all, what are the significant events that I remember the most in my life? What are the significant events that I remember the most? All right, that one's fairly easy, right? Significant, I remember them the most. The flip side of that question is number two. What are the significant events that I tend not to remember? You might need some help from somebody on this one. Or what are those things that I tend to suppress that I tried to put away from my mind? Now, I'm not talking about digging up old things that are going to hurt necessarily, okay? You might literally need third-party help to do that. And I'm serious about that. I'm not being facetious at all, but I'm being very serious about that. Here's number three. When did I succeed and what did it look like? When did I succeed and what did it look like? All right. And then four, when did I blow it? And what did it look like? When did I blow it? And what did it look like? Now these questions are intended to give you a starting point. But I think if you answer these questions honestly, you'll be able to get a handle on what is and what has been. Because really, that's what Jesus was getting at with the lady at the woman at the well. He was revealing to her, first of all, the reality of who she was. And who she was at that point in time was a product of what she had been all the rest of her life. Right? So that's one of the first steps we got to take, is to define what is, what has been. We never solve problems without identifying the problems first. So often we spend our lives working on symptoms rather than the real issues. Right? You go to a doctor, I got a cough, doc. Oh, okay, well here, let me give you some Luden's cough drops. Call me back in 2 weeks. Duh. When in reality we have a lung disease, you know? Many of us are satisfied with the self-diagnosis of Luden's cough drops. And we never even begin to think about the possibility of the lung disease that exists. The woman at the well was going to be satisfied with the Luden's cough drops. She, at this point in her life, was not interested until Jesus began radical surgery, which is what we're going to look at next time we look at John chapter 4. Let's pray. Father, thanks for your challenge through this story, one of the most illustrative, impactful stories, I think, that we find in the Gospels. So I thank you for it. I thank you for the identity that we can have with the woman at the well. And God, I want to thank you that in the end, she bared her soul to Jesus. She became honest. Thanks that that's an example for us. God, I pray for each and every person in this room today, myself included in that group, that you will make us honest about what is and what has been. And God, that as we look at that, that you will begin to really make us motivated and ambitious about what can be. Not so much what we see as being able to happen in our own power, but rather that which can happen when we step out on faith and when we define what can be at that point. God, thanks for the struggle that you have in mind for us this week. May we give attention to the encounters that we have with you. Those direct communication times when we are called to hear what you're saying and address what you're saying. Those times when we have opportunities to build a more integrated and holistic relationship with you rather than one that is compartmentalized in a little box. God, show us and teach us how to respond, how to process and how to respond like the woman at the well would ultimately do. God, thanks for your protection. Thanks for your love. Thanks for love that is not predicated on the love of anyone else, but is based solely on the love that you have for us individually. God, may we live into that love, and may we love others with that love as well. For it's in Christ's name that we pray. Amen. Thanks for being here today. I want you to make sure you fill out your connection card before you leave, and leave your tithes and your offerings, our regulars. We would greatly appreciate that. We would greatly want you to remember that and want you to spend some time maybe fellowshipping with one another as you leave today. Leave those cards and the tithes and offerings in the boxes in the back. Notice, too, that we have an opportunity for you to help our students get new chairs. One of those chairs is right there in front of the fountain as you walk in the door, what we're buying. $15.09 is all it takes. And, you know, we're going to buy five of those, my family. And I want to encourage you to buy one, two, three, four, whatever you got, whatever you want to do. If you've got a teenager or a rising teenager, you might want to go ahead and consider contributing to that. God bless. Have a great day and a great week.